namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Canto 1, Chapter 17, texts, start with text 12. There's a theme, so it goes through 12, 13, 14. The verses that we discussed together where Maharaj Pariksit addressing the personality of Kali, yes? And after he addresses the personality of Kali, he begins addressing the bull, the victim, you know, the perpetrator and the victim. And then in the course of speaking to the bull, he begins speaking to both the cow and the bull. The first question to the bull is, who are you? Are you a demigod who has appeared just to help those that don't know the future of the age of Kali to understand what the future will be? Causing us grief to see you in this condition. He then describes it's the first time in my rule as the king that something like this has happened. Because when there's a qualified king, this never happens. Where it's, he doesn't use the word terrorism, but he practically uses the word terrorism. Those that give great fear and terror to other living entities, such persons are to be killed, death penalty. And I've come to protect you, so there's no cause to continue crying. Everything will be good for you. He's trying to reassure Dharma that he will uphold the principles. And Prabhupada says many interesting things. The prime duty of a king is to give protection, specifically to provide their God-given natural rights, not only to live, but to live as they would normally, provided they don't infringe upon the rights of others. So he gives the example of wild animals. They have the right to live. Someone just goes and starts killing wild animals, well, that's punishable. Or if the wild animals go and start killing other than what was intended for them as their food, meaning causing great disruption and disturbance in human society, then that animal is to be killed. And it's not a wrong on the part of the king to do so, it's the wrong on the part of the king to not do so. Then he speaks strongly about standards that are given by God and the tendency of people in modern society to go on their whim and fancy, to go on their likes and their dislikes. their beliefs and personal beliefs and sentiments, is his phrase. We spent some time discussing, you know, where does that lead to? Personal beliefs and sentiments. Because that is what goes on, and it's what, by definition, it's what the dictionary definition of religion is, a system of beliefs. So that whatever you believe in, that's what your religion is. Anyway, I won't re-speak those same classes, but even with good intention, even getting some part of it right, like, you know, protection, save the extinguishing species, and save the salamanders, and so on. Even, you know, protesting animal slaughter, and save the cow, protect the cow. Without doing so under, besides common sense and morality, under the authority of God, then it's not enduring. The very nature of the material world will corrode and corrupt that principle until it's unrecognizable anymore. We gave examples. So, Maharaj Pariksit continues, speaking to the bull. O son of Surabhi, now he's asking, you know, who did it? Name the aggressor. I'm here to punish the aggressor. It's kind of obvious, there's this man with a club. And he's already, you know, accused him. Now he's asking, you know, the victim, who did it? In the case of the kings who are obedient to the laws of the Supreme Personality, Godhead Krishna, there is no one as unhappy as you. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The kings, or the executive heads of all states, must know the codes of Lord Krishna, generally Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and must act accordingly in order to fulfill the mission of human life, which is to make an end of all miseries of material conditions. One who knows the codes of Lord Krishna can achieve this end without any difficulty. In the Bhagavad Gita, in a synopsis, we can understand the codes of Godhead. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, the same codes are explained further. It's just like the pronouncement made by Maharaj Pariksit that one who has done, he's speaking to the bull, one who has done what this person has done deserves to receive that punishment, that penalty. Therefore, I must kill this most wretched man because he is violent against other living beings. So, there are codes in Manu, Samhita, the laws of Manu, that indicate appropriate punishments for sins. This wrongdoing has this punishment, that wrongdoing has another punishment. So, here it's enshrined in the Bhagavatam. It's not just something archaic, because there are some things in the Manu Samhita that it'd be very hard to follow Manu Samhita in all respects. But it's in the Bhagavatam. So, one who knows the codes of Lord Krishna can achieve this end. This end is the fulfillment of the human mission. It was that end all miseries of material conditions. One can achieve that end without difficulty. In the Bhagavad Gita, in a synopsis, you can understand the codes of Godhead. And in Srimad Bhagavatam, the same codes are explained further. In a state where the codes of Krishna are not followed, no one is happy. In the state where the codes of Krishna are followed, no one is unhappy. That's Vaikuntha. Where such codes are not followed, the first sign is that the three legs of the representative of religion are cut off, and thereby all miseries follow. When Krishna was personally present, the codes of Krishna were being followed without question. But in his absence, such codes are presented in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam for the guidance of the blind persons who happen to be at the helm of all affairs. As you know, stated in the first chapter of this first canto, the sages say to Sutta Goswami, in this age of Kali, people aren't going to take the time to go through all the Vedas and understand what the Vedas mean and glean from them the essence. They're not going to do it. They don't have the capacity, they don't have the sufficient interest, they're lazy. Even if somebody tried, they're misguided. So the codes are made in an essence form very simple and accessible through the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam and, of course, rare to find people who will go through the Srimad Bhagavatam. And even those that go through the Srimad Bhagavatam can go through proper versions of Srimad Bhagavatam. Kali Yuga is an ocean of faults. So when Krishna was present, when there was discrepancy, he came and he established proper standards by his own acts and by annihilating the deviant personalities wholesale, liberating them from their material existence, but also liberating the rest of the world from having to deal with these demoniac personalities, particularly demoniac kings. So, we know that the Srimad Bhagavatam is the presentation, provides the presentation of religious principles suitable for this age as a literary incarnation of Krishna, specifically embodying, once again, those codes of Krishna. Okay, so the next verse he asks him again, who did it? O bull, you are offenseless and thoroughly honest, therefore I wish all good to you. Please tell me of the perpetrator of these mutilations which blackmail the reputation of the sons of Pritha. What does that mean? They blackmail the reputation. What does blackmail mean? You know something about another person, or somebody knows something. Person A knows something bad about person B. Person A says to person B, I'm going to tell other people about this bad thing unless you give me what I want, which is often money. But it could be something else, something I want. You give me something I want, and I'll not harm you with this bad thing I know about you. It's like that. So the Pandavas, being upholders of virtue, and now the descendant of the Pandus, the Pandavas, in the form of Maharaj Parikshit, it's a bad mark against them and their descendant Maharaj Parikshit. So to remove that stain, that bad thing, he's prepared to take to the right thing. Just, if this is a trial, he didn't like, you know, take it to court and you get a lawyer and you get a lawyer and sit before the judge. This is not that system. He's the judge and the jury and the executioner in one person because he's qualified. And it's fair. He's asking, you know, not just assuming. Purport. The reputation of the reign of Maharaj Ramachandra and that of the kings who followed in the footsteps of Maharaj Ramachandra, like the Pandavas and their descendants, are never to be forgotten because in their kingdom, offenseless and honest living beings were never in trouble. The bull and the cow are symbols of the most offenseless living beings because even the stool and the urine of these animals are utilized to benefit human society. The descendants of the sons of Pritha, like Maharaj Parikshit, so the sons of Pritha, who's Pritha? Kunti's sons. The descendants of Kunti's sons, descendants of the Pandavas, like Maharaj Parikshit, were afraid of losing their reputations. But in the modern days, the leaders are not even afraid of killing such offenseless animals. Herein lies the difference between the reign of those pious kings and the modern states ruled by irresponsible executive heads without knowledge of the codes of God. It's one way of saying it, as Prabhupada says it in different ways in different places, that Maharaj Parikshit wanted to uphold the honor of his ancestors. And you say it the negative way. He did not want the shame of straying from the path of his ancestors and thus bringing shame to them. And for a virtuous person, that's important. It's just like as devotees of Krishna consciousness, we're representing Srila Prabhupada. So if somebody, any followers of Srila Prabhupada, don't live to the standard that Prabhupada taught, it puts a stain on his good name. Or the other way around. If someone behaves according to the teachings and standards given by Srila Prabhupada, they give honor and glory to Srila Prabhupada. And so, devotee wants to do that. And they don't want to do the other. That's... In the purport, Prabhupada is indicating that's what Maharaj Parikshit is saying. That what has happened to you, my dear son of Surabhi, I want to remove this stain on the good name of the Pandavas and myself by bringing just punishment, curbing this personality who has done this to you. Whoever causes offenseless living beings to suffer must fear me anywhere and everywhere in this world. By curbing dishonest miscreants, one automatically benefits the offenseless. It's common sense, but it's a nice way to say it. So in one sense, it's like, you know, an administrator is like a police officer who is looking for people who are offending. Like on the highways, I don't know if you have this here, but in America, the state police, they set up their radar traps and people are speeding, because you're violating the law, you're causing some difficulty to others. But the police force works just the opposite for a law-abiding person. It's, you know, your friend. Hello, officer. But the person who's the criminal is, uh-oh, here comes the police officer. By the presence of strong government, it immediately curbs the tendencies of miscreants. It gives happiness to the law-abiding persons. They think, oh, this is a safe place because we have a good officer or set of officers enforcing the law and protecting the good citizens. So a king needs to do that. And the theme of this section is he needs to do it according to codes given by God. He needs to know what those codes are. He needs to administer according to those codes. We spent some time this morning discussing, you know, who's going to go for that? Who's going to go for no slaughterhouses? Supposing somebody got elected, yeah, even in this country, no slaughterhouses. Oh. They can have a backlash. No alcohol. No alcohol production or consumption. Chai, coffee. No chai, no coffee. No cigarettes. Oh, he's going to have, you know, an uproar. You know, get this guy out of here. You know, the business interests alone would do what to speak of the consumers. Consumers alone would do it, would to speak of the business people. So we have disruption. Text 14. Whoever causes, yeah, we read this, offenseless living beings to suffer must fear me anywhere and everywhere in the world. By curbing dishonest miscreants, one automatically benefits the offenseless. Okay. Purport. Dishonest miscreants. Is there such a thing as an honest miscreant? Anyway, dishonest miscreants flourish because of cowardly and impotent executive heads of state. But when the executive heads are strong enough to curb all sorts of dishonest miscreants in any part of the state, certainly, they cannot flourish. When the miscreants are punished in an exemplary manner, automatically all good fortune follows, as said before. It is the prime duty of the king or the executive head of state to give protection in all respects to the peaceful, offenseless citizens of the state. Time when in New York City, the crime, the mayor was so ineffective that the rate of crime was increasing and increasing and increasing and increasing. It was way out of control. And some of the main revenue of New York City, namely tourism, was going down and down and down, so they had less money to fight crime with. Then they got a good mayor. And crime went down and down and down, and he was like broadcasting it. Come on over from Europe. This is one of the safest cities in the world. And you know, tourism went way, way up because it was very safe. But it used to be, you know, to stand on a street corner, you don't know if somebody's going to come along and clobber you. It's not like that now, but it was way out of hand at some point. So people stopped coming. A little inside information. I didn't know this until Devamrita Swami told me. His father was, or is, I think he's retired now, during that administration, was a leading officer in the New York City police force. So the system was that they kept very careful track of where crimes happened. And their assignment was not to catch the people and punish them, but before they do the crimes, diminish the incidents that you have to go out and respond to. So they were given, they call them precincts, like, you know, geographic area. There's a commander of the precinct. Okay, you've got 6 months to reduce the crime, the number of events that happen. You got to be proactive and get out there and go in the hardcore places, find out who the problem makers are and resolve it before the problem happens. And if you don't do that in 6 months, you're out. Someone else will come in. They had like computerized and tracked everything and went into people's homes, and you know, because that's where problems start, in homes. And they started addressing, you know, domestic turmoil in order to prevent crime that came out of the frustration with something that was disturbing in the home. And it worked. Crime went way, way down. Then they got it so that, you know, even they were moving precincts around. Okay, this is a quiet place, so we got some problems over there, we'll move that precinct over there. They were very potent, using the term proactive. They were anticipating where there would be problems and catching the problem before it happened. Very good. Very good. I don't have much good to say about politicians, but there was one good guy that he did a number of things that were all very good. As far as administration, he was a nice Duryodhan. He could control his senses. He had, you know, some problems in his own marriage that was embarrassing and stuff, but he was administratively strong. When the miscreants are punished in an exemplary manner, automatically all good fortune follows. As said before, it is the prime duty of the king or executive head to give protection in all respects to the peaceful, offenseless citizens of the state. The devotees of the Lord are by nature peaceful and offenseless, and therefore it is the prime duty of the state to arrange to convert everyone to become a devotee of the Lord. Haribol. Thus automatically there will be peaceful, offenseless citizens. Then the only duty of the king will be to curb the dishonest miscreants. Sound like the same program as before. So that would mean those that dress themselves like but don't uphold the standards of. That's a governmental function, you see. That will bring about peace and harmony all over human society. So we're getting the picture of the influence of Kali upon, you know, there's it's intriguing how the Bhagavad Gita is doing this. It's layers of things. The influence of, upon the age of Kali on protection of cows and bulls, the influence of the age of Kali on miscreants and heads of state. The influence of the age of Kali on heads of state is they don't know what is to be done, what's not to be done. They're not, there's no cultural rejuvenation using Prabhupada's language. So they don't know. And the miscreants, therefore, are not properly dealt with, generally speaking. And if you find somebody that's good, then you know, they're gone after some time because of the system of limits of terms. Why is there a system of limits of terms? Because people can't, once they get in a position of authority or power for some time, then often they become corrupted. So you have to limit them, numbers in terms of office. Like, you know, they know they're not good people, that's why we have to limit them. They'll get attached. Peace and prosperity. Prabhupada uses those two terms together, peace and prosperity, very, very often in his first canto purports. Peace and prosperity. Because that's what people want. They want to be peaceful. And they want to prosper. The standard of prosperity is not just how many different things you have and then you're prosperous. I mean, it's the conventional thing. The more toys a child has, the happier you're supposed to be. Or the more money somebody has, the happier they're supposed to be. Or the more titles they have, or the more something they have, the more more happy they're supposed to be. It's the standard of happiness. But it's not a standard of happiness. So-called. The suicide rate, so many statistics, but one of them is the suicide rate amongst millionaires is the greatest, percentage-wise. You get all those things that are supposed to make them happy, and they're not happy. Frustration. They had a big expectation. It didn't happen. And they had to hurt so many people along the way to get that wealth. So, the prosperity that Prabhupada speaks of when he uses peace and prosperity is not just, you know, gross national product or a booming economy. It's the people are in their heart satisfied. That's a progressive and prospering society. And the innocent people, the law-abiding people, they're given protection and shelter and safety. They have a sense of safe. That's good. That's the peace and prosperity. So this section of the Bhagavatam is giving us that emphasis, that the peace and prosperity that people want in this world will come by knowing the codes of God and upholding the codes of God. So we don't have that on the government platform, so we're left to our own devices, you know, within our own spiritual communities. We know what the standards of God are and abide by them, and be peaceful and prosperous in life. Try to help other people who don't understand to understand in different ways, according to our capacity. Just as Prabhupada is doing through his writing of transcendental literature, and then we can do through the distribution of transcendental literature, broadcasting this message. Reading through the whole thing is, it's simultaneously encouraging and discouraging, because speaking about it again and again, you know, verse after verse, and you know what the ills of Kali Yuga are, is not very enlightening. But the enlivening part is Bhagavatam is providing us the means for very clearly understanding it in an authentic way, and providing us the means of shelter. We can't provide that shelter for the whole world because people don't want it. But the people that do want it, to really provide some genuine shelter. Okay. Any thoughts, comments on these verses? Something?
Well, like when we see the influence of Kali, in others' life, and even in our life, knowing that we have proper shelter, so we know that we have a duty to actually to live by the teachings which we are. And like how it means.
Why don't we do it?
Yeah, means how. Yeah. It's how to deepen our capacity more and more to actually to accept the message more deeply in our heart.
Someone wrote to me just today. Still have their ups and downs, but they see that the downs they can get out of it much more quickly. And in general, there's a sense of contentment with life that wasn't there before. My response was, this is purification. There's no substitute for purity. Something that gives one an impetus, as your question was, to go more deeply, is happiness. From Drishtrandavartate. Experiencing a higher taste, we can then know that higher taste comes from purity. We can then know this is available to me all the time. So the other alternatives, particularly our own conditioning, pales. Just loses its traction. If we're diligent. Another person was describing to me that their whole professional life before they were a devotee, they had a certain circle of friends. And with that circle of friends, they would do things. But they found, I don't have the interest to do those things. And then my friend calls me up and, okay, it's, you know, every month we've been doing this for years. We'll go to, you know, some intellectually stimulating educational function together and go and experience it and then talk about it and share our experience with one another. And the devotee said, I don't want to do that anymore. I don't want to do that anymore. I just want to sit home and read Bhagavatam. And I doubt they won't understand that. I just want to stay home and read the Bhagavatam. I find more satisfaction in that than this other. So my response, included in my response, I'm not giving you the things that you're used to hearing, I'm giving you some other ones because you know the ones that you're used to hearing. There's no substitute for purity, and through purity there can be a higher taste, and when there's higher taste, then there's an eagerness to go more deeply. And then it's also not artificial. Like, I'm doing it because I know I should do it. But I'm doing it, you know, I'm going more deeply, I'm practicing more diligently, because I like it. It brings me happiness. And it's a happiness that's so much nicer than this other kind of so-called happiness, if I say the happiness of achieving something. Our lives are filled with things that we've achieved, and where's that happiness? Contentment. It's not there. It's, you know, struggle with the next thing, the next mountain to climb, or objective to conquer, or something. That was a jet lag and go on. We have to get to the soul platform. And to get to the soul platform, there's so many layers of other things. Another way of saying there's no substitute for purity. Because even the language go more deeply can just be rhetoric when we're in fact we're not. That I've been doing this past year is helping people go more deeply into the holy name. Because Because my conviction is everything starts with the Holy Name, our relationship with the Holy Name. Whatever it is that we have, it's substance, it's sustenance, it's, you know, the whole thing, it's everything has come from the chanting. So qualitatively, how do we go more deeply into the chanting of the Holy Name? And you, because your question was how to, so just the coming together, like, you know, you have your yatras. That's a big how-to. Because when persons that are very serious-minded come together in a concentrated place and, you know, extending over some number of days, it helps one go more deeply into a subject matter that otherwise we don't go as deeply into, even the same subject matter, even with the from the same person. It, the association of devotees in a very focused manner, or in a, especially in a sacred place, over a number of days, it's very powerful. Very, very powerful. And then comes, oh gee, I wish we could do this all the time. Or then comes, yeah, but after I go back, and then it goes back to usual, you know, business as usual. So how do I stay in that? Then it comes to purity. And we sustain a sincere effort regardless of what the experience is, out of a sense of wanting to be pure, a sense of gratitude, a sense of, you know, getting onto the spiritual platform where things aren't caused or stopped by material circumstance. There's no substitute for purity to get there. So we have to keep striving. Over time, very diligently. Something else? You had something?
In relation to means chanting, actually most of the time we don't realize that how it increases our relationship with the spiritual precept or something. Means by hearing, we know, at least we can know that by doing proper hearing and all, okay, we can tell a relationship with spiritual precept. But by chanting the Holy Name, means most of the time we feel lackadaisical, or means that seriousness is not there in chanting.
Why is the seriousness not there?
The importance of most of the time is not to clear.
Okay. So then make it clear. Take the prior question and your question and put them together, and conducting yatras or retreats that's just focusing on the quality of chanting has the effect of increasing the quality of chanting. And understanding the importance of why. Because it's entrance into the spiritual world just from chanting the Holy Name properly. And if one can experience that, even a glimpse, and there you understand, then you get realization about the importance of chanting. But it's not a quick fix. It's something that requires a sustained effort. F- For example, there's somebody that just wrote to me like how they came to Krishna consciousness, became involved. And it's, you know, skipping a number of events. It was spanning over a period of 7-8 years before they started to really seriously take up chanting. Over that 7 years, there was, you know, a series of coming and go, fading and coming forward and meeting different devotees and, you know, connecting with different devotees. But when their chanting just started really taking off was, they weren't even like fired up to do it. It just kind of, they went along with a group of people to take part in one of these, you know, increase the quality of your chanting. We call it Festival of the Holy Name. And from that time, their chanting right away went up to 16 rounds and just kept going. And with an understanding, because, you know, and reinforced by other similar experiences that happened subsequently. As far as connecting chanting itself to your spiritual preceptor, where did you get the chanting from? Wasn't there a time in your life when you weren't chanting? And now you're chanting? So where'd that come from? It's a service. It connects you directly with Krishna because the sound of Krishna's name and Krishna are non-different. But where'd you get that from? Who introduced you to Krishna? So the connection is there. Thinking otherwise would be a symptom of ingratitude. Is that right? I mean, you can't, if your question is to separate those who represent Krishna from Krishna, that's a mistake. Because it's not even so. Those that represent Krishna are connected to Krishna. You can't separate them. Like Prabhupada once said, how can you think of the spiritual master without Krishna? How can you think of Krishna without the spiritual master? In this case, it's the holy name. And through wisdom and a little good training, to see that person who may have given you the holy name, where did they get the holy name from, and where did they get the holy name from, and, you know, connecting one to the whole specific succession, ultimately to Krishna, who's the giver of his own holy name. You're brought into the spiritual world. There's immediate personality who has been instrumental in your life in doing that. But they're not disconnected from Krishna either. Okay? Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai, Natarāja Śrīmad Bhāgavatam ki jai, Prabhupāda ki jai. Thank you.